Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
All right, folks, call is going to begin here in a few minutes. Good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Tuesday night installment here at Your Remedies in the Law with our speaker, Brother John. Tonight's topic is information that you can use and sometimes cannot use in court. My name is Martin Michelson. I'll be your host for this evening's conference call brought to you by Your Remedies in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer. Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. You're on this call because of the situation in your life where you require legal advice, and I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone looking for legal advice has no place or business here on any of these calls. Nobody here at Your Remedies in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes, just folks saying what they might do were they similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions, as experienced and powerful as these folks' opinions might be, at the end of the day, they are just that. They're just people's opinions. And it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremediesinthelaw.com. We look up in the upper right-hand corner, see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you have a separate page come up with just two items on it, otherwise blank page. These two items are of much importance, especially if this is all new to you. On the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure, better known to some as American jurisprudence or AMJUR. The rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic concept of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you might find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process. Of course, primarily known for its very high win rate, 95-97% national average win rate throughout the country. That's what it's pretty much known for. That's what it's most commonly procured for. But that's not why it's up here. The reason that it's up here, once you've gone through the jurisdictionary course and you start getting into the common law default, you'll see very quickly that it almost acts like a real-life homework assignment. So especially if you're starting out fresh in this thing, this is all brand new to you. A lot of folks feel more comfortable getting their feet wet with their first time with a traffic scenario, given the fact that it's a traffic scenario. Of course, it's going to happen for most traffic cases. Worst case scenario, if you mess something up, you just have to pay a ticket or whatever it may be. And so, but the core pillars that you learned about in the jurisdictionary line up perfectly with what the common law default is having you enact. So, it's just a great starting point. With a very generous asking of just a very meager contribution of $250 for the jurisdictionary and $150 for the common law default, I encourage you to pick that up at your earliest convenience. Also, while you're there, right underneath that login there, you'll see register. Whenever you're ready, whenever you it's convenient for you, you want to click on register. And again, a very, very meager asking of a $10 a month monthly contribution gives you full membership to your remedy. Many wonderful features, study aids, books. Of course, every call is recorded. You've got years and years of archives, a vast wealth of knowledge and experience there to listen to on these calls. Now, of course, if you're not ready for that or if that's not for you just yet, you've got freedomsradio.com, www.freedomsradio.com. Every call is broadcasted out over the air. That is completely free. Charges free to you. You don't ever have to miss a call again if you don't wish. You're not going to get the one-on-one again with the information providers like you could get at your remedy for the membership, but even at Freedoms Radio, you've got that little question bar there where you can type in a question or comment. As long as you remember to click submit, that will pop up on our side, and we do our best to read every one of those out. We're usually pretty much 100% successful on that. We read all those out over the air. So, again, you never have to miss a call again or an interaction if you don't wish. But it is encouraged to pick up your remedy membership as soon as you're able to. All right. Keep it going here. Grassfire Communications. Better known as formerly Statewide Communications. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. What we're trying to do here very simply is put the power of communication and the power of education back in the hands of the common man. You've got a very simple install wizard, setup wizard. You know, put your name in here, click next, zip code, click next. Then it's going to ask you to pick from a very long list of topics. No matter what your situation, no matter what you're thinking of, you'll find it in that list or close enough to it, whether it's a status correction or home foreclosures, credit cards, traffic, human rights, veterans' rights, health rights, just on and on. You'll find it in that list. Then there's something about a radius there. Do you want it within 5 miles of your house? Or you want it about 50 miles out? Your choice there. Give you a few different options at least, I'm sure. And when it's all done, it puts it together kind of how most people would probably speak of the social media. But it's nothing like social media. It's very custom. It's very private. But how some people would feel about social media, it puts you in contact there with local people there that share similar interests. So maybe you jump on there one day and say, this happens to me today. Well, the first person comes back and says, well, I don't think they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's a very truthful statement, but it's probably not going to help you very much in your educational process. Maybe the next person comes in and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do if I was similarly situated. I'd go down to my local county courthouse, go to the law library. By the way, if you didn't know, every county has its courthouse. Every courthouse has a law library. I'd look up these terms, and then I'd watch this YouTube video. Well, now you start to get somewhere. Now you're actually getting some information that you might actually be able to use there to educate yourself. Maybe the third person comes along and says, I think that's a great idea. Also, I'd go to this website, urlusinglaw.com, and I'd purchase this educational process. I'd talk to this person. I'd watch these videos over here. Check out this speaker, what he's got. Now you're really getting somewhere. Now you're getting traction. And that's, again, all we're trying to do here is just put the power of communication in the back of the hands of the common man, get people to start speaking again. If you're doing your own due diligence and you're just acting aside your rights, so there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. All right. You might have noticed every time you go to Your Remedies in the Law, that little blue box pops up asking if you want to continue on to the site you requested or go over to Americans Restoring America. The reason we've done that is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are many different information providers talking about many different topics. And that's all at Your Remedy. And Your Remedy is one of a dozen and a half websites that all together make up Americans Restoring America. And so there's a lot there for you to see, and we're just encouraging you to do that. If you ever have a question on whether we have an information provider that could assist you in your particular educational process, you can always call the 1-800 number, 1-800-625-4250. Again, that's 1-800-625-4250. Or you can always just email me directly, mmmartinmichelson@yourremediesinthelaw.com. I'll get you squared away as quickly as possible. All right, winding down here, this next portion is called your caveat emptor or your buyer beware. When you come aboard with an information provider here at Your Remedies in the Law, you're doing just that. You're going directly with an information provider. Now, not every plan of attack for every information provider, for every person, is guaranteed to be a success. Of course, you know, nothing in life is ever guaranteed. Now, the plan is always to be successful. If there's any question of that, we encourage you to check out yourremediesinthelaw.com/testimonials and very quickly see what other folks have had to say. And we'll just kind of stand on that. But nothing is ever guaranteed. But that brings up the more important question of what is the refund or credit policy at Your Remedies in the Law. There is none. Again, if there was going to be anything of that nature, that would be a strict and private matter between you and your information provider. But even then, that's probably going to be extenuating circumstances. Usually, you're expected, again, to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. You're expected to have made that decision that you mesh well, that you think that you would do well with a student-teacher relationship with your information provider before you, you know, do that final commitment. All right, lastly here, and this goes for all the information providers, all of our speakers at Your Remedies in the Law, just Brother John here. We want to remind everybody that all of these speakers at these calls are our guests and should always be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's perfectly fine. Disagreeing is how we learn. But you are always expected to be civil and maintain composure. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we all get to learn something from it. All right, well, that is my ramble for this evening, folks. So without further ado, it is my pleasure to introduce our speaker for this evening, Brother John. We're very excited to have you here. What have you got? Well, I've told him, of course, our topic for tonight, being the some things that you may or may not want to say or do in court. Take us away.
Good evening, Martin. Thank you for your kind and gracious introduction. The topic tonight is information. I didn't say evidence. Information that you can or can't, sometimes cannot use in court. And the object here is that before you ever get to court, that you test all your information so that you know that it's usable and will stand up. There's a lot of times where you may be baiting or debating with the prosecutor or the opposing party, or you know, even the witness, and you bring something up or the witness brings something up an opposing party says, makes a comment like, objection, Your Honor, hearsay. And you ask yourself, well, no, I know this for a fact. Well, maybe you do know it for a fact, but maybe it was a witness at the scene of the accident that told you what happened, or told the person that's on the witness stand what happened. And they said, well, this person explained it exactly what happened, and you know you've got the facts straight, and you've talked to four people, and they all have the facts straight, and there were three people that heard the same person or say exactly what happened, but they didn't witness it personally. And so what happens is that all of a sudden, you know, some of your key information gets struck down the hard way. I'll preface tonight's discussion with something called the Federal Rules of Evidence. And if you like to learn more about that, then what I suggest you do is that you can just type into a search engine rules of evidence or federal rules of evidence. And one of the first search items that comes up is the LII, Legal Information Institute. It's Cornell Law School. And by the way, every so often, they don't ask much before it, you know, but every so often, I'll get a very quiet email asking for donations. That Legal Information Institute is a self-funded, not-for-profit aspect of an outreach of a handful of the students and faculty at Cornell Law. They do not have a regular funding for it. From time to time they do get grants, but it's mostly self-funded out of their own pocket. So if you use that research tool much like I do, giving them whatever you want, a 50 cents, $50, or $500 if you can afford it, is never a bad thing. They do a good job, and the integrity of that information is, I rate it up above 95, 98 percentile. I have yet to find more than one error in the 12 and a half years that I've been using that research tool. And that one was a typo that they corrected immediately. That's why I put it up in the 95, 98 percentile category, is because once they realized that there was a typo there, they corrected it immediately. And I mean, the very next day, I logged back on and refreshed my screen, and it was corrected. And the Federal Rules of Evidence, if you go down to the 800s, rule 801 talks about what hearsay is. The rule against 802 is the rule of against hearsay, and there's exceptions to hearsay, regardless of whether the declarant is available to be the witness. Now, see, one of the things that hearsay is that the opposing party cannot cross-examine the witness. And even though the testimony may be absolutely accurate, but finding out and getting the discretion about some little aspect of it that's most extremely critical to their cause or their case is just not possible when there's another person giving that information. Whether you know it to be true or somebody else knows it to be true, what happens is so that you don't end up in a questionable situation where it's hearsay, you know, maybe eight people saw the guy drive across your lawn, knock down the post box, and leave tracks across your muddy tracks across your lawn and tear up your lawn. But the only three people you could get into court are the ones that had time to be there, and they were neighbors that none of them actually saw it. You're not going to go very far on that one. If there's a way to get the first person party that actually witnessed the event. That's extremely important. Many a capital murder case has been dismissed, or they've voted not guilty because the critical evidence was hearsay. And there's a now I'm going to refer to a very, very prominent capital murder trial here. Most of you know who O.J. Simpson is, or and has been or was, and you're most aware about his trial that for murdering his wife. And I'll say for murdering his wife, I may have had access to evidence that was not hearsay at one time, and I have more of a preponderance of evidence on that that O.J. was guilty. In fact, many of you probably remember that attorney that was representing O.J. Simpson, he used the term hearsay, objection hearsay evidence many, many times in that trial, to the point where Judge Ito was absolutely beside himself. And what happened was that there was a big flurry in the news on the well into the trial, where Judge Ito took a break, just disappeared. And Johnny Cochran made a big, big point of the fact that Judge Ito left all of those jurors sweltering in the heat, sequestered from their families, but in a hotel that the heating, the HVAC, was down in for 2 of the 3 days that Judge Ito had also apparently disappeared. Now, what I'm about to say for all of you is absolute hearsay. And if it actually occurred, it would probably be confidential or classified, and I couldn't tell you. And if it didn't occur, I couldn't tell you anyway. So we haven't talked. I haven't seen you. In fact, I'm not me. I'm some other guy. I'm from the Bronx. And at the same time, after I got out of the Air Force in the 70s and while I was at law and stuff, I was putting my way through self through school working for the Defense Department. I may not be a conspiracy theorist. There is a vague chance I might be a former conspirer. To that end, I may have been doing some consulting work for our uncle at the time, and I got to see, I may have gotten to see, the satellite imagery, not just the regular imagery, but because I may have been one of the people that rolled out the first time, or the first real-time satellite in photography, thermographic imaging capacity back in the 70s. I may have been asked for to help to do some consulting on supporting the data that they were bringing up. I wasn't allowed to know what I was getting into, but what happened was that someone invited Judge Ito to see the satellite footage, not just the real-time satellite footage, but also the thermographic, or the in-photography, meaning that your infrared signature is more unique than your thumbprint. And the satellite in photography now is so good that they have 74% of Americans' infrared signature mapped. What that basically means is that you can take a huge Walmart or a trucking terminal, take 8,000 people, put 180 passenger buses, pull them all in at the same time, take those 8,000 people, distribute them to those 80 passenger buses, to those 180 passenger buses, and the buses leave. In less than 42 seconds, they will know which they can identify which bus you're on and which seat you're on using your thermograph right through the aluminum roof of those buses. By the way, this is pre-Columbian art, prehistoric technology. This technology I'm sharing with you is over 38 years old. Okay? So they might have gotten just a teeny bit better at it. But the case in point was is that they had not just OJ's thermograph, but his wife's. And they showed in vivid detail, brutal detail, OJ doing what he did. And it also shows in vivid, brutal detail, Al Collins picking OJ up and driving him away from it. My brother did all, owns the single largest job shop custom cabinet and furniture shop in Southern California at the time. And he had just, he was just finishing Al Collins, holiday or retreat home on doing all of their cabinetry and everything in it. A $750,000 cabinet job. He and Al Collins were best friends. Al said that he could not testify in the trial and would not and refuse to. And to that end, he did confide in my brother what happened. They took Judge Ito out there and showed him the not just the regular footage that showed the lights on his vehicle and everything traveling. They showed him the thermograph, and it showed all of the brutal details. Okay. 3 days later, Judge Ito returns back to society from up in the California desert there on his little vacation. Judge Ito knew all the facts. And the person that was making the decision had seen all the evidence firsthand. He would have been, because he's the judge, he would have been required to have someone testify and affy, swear to, the integrity of that evidence. There was nobody that would. In fact, anybody involved with it was severely instructed and encouraged that if they ever said anything about it to anybody, that it might go hard for them and they might live out the rest of their life in a 6x6x6 at Guantanamo, or may not even make it to Gitmo at the time. It's many years later now, and there's been a little bit of release and grace on it, but the point is that even the judge, Judge Ito, had the strongest possible evidence to convict OJ, except that he's the judge. Actually, wait a minute. Oh, no, he's not. There were 12 judges and 2 alternates that we call a jury. And there's a lot of judges that, and then man makes God in his own image. And they're a little ascended, and they think they're the God's gift to mankind. And if you don't believe me, just ask them. And all of us are subject to egos, and our egos sometimes write checks that our butt can't cash. But Judge Ito was fretting horribly over the facts that he knew versus what was being introduced in evidence. And he even tried to guide the prosecution into helping, but he couldn't. He couldn't give away one drop of information. And don't worry, it's much worse than you think. Because he didn't have anybody to testify it, not one character or punctuation mark of that evidence could come to the jury's attention. It had to come through a path by with which they could present it, and both parties could cross-examine it, okay? Examine and cross-examine. And that it had to be a party of the first part. Wait a minute. Don't worry, it's much worse than you think. The Defense Department, there's no way that they would allow that type of intelligence out. The biggest, single biggest problem is that the satellite thermography is still, we had a senator, 34 years ago that, I had to go to DC for a Senate oversight hearing, a funding hearing committee. And, when she realized the satellite thermography, what it was, and that it doesn't, have the clothing, even on the, individual that's under surveillance, it only sees the, body and the tissue, and that the, even the hair follicles, on the nipples of the, individuals there were clearly visible under high resolution. Remember, this is 34 years ago. This is nothing recent. That, so you can just imagine how much better the technology and the resolution has gotten. They had to, she freaked out and almost canceled the funding bill because, she realized how naked she would be. And actually it was, in the satellite thermography. They had an artificially intelligent expert system software that began to put clothes on those under surveillance. And the, it's, and it would surmise based on what their, daytime dress were. It developed, this thing develops an artificially intelligent expert system profile of every individual in the U.S. And so to that end, it has an idea what kind of clothes you wear just from the satellite imagery, let alone, you know, the traffic cams and everything else that it's constantly collecting data off of. But these traffic cams and everything else, most of that data, a lot of that is not available for use in court. So what happens is that sometimes the point here that we're going to make is that sometimes regardless of what kind of information and evidence you have, you have to make sure that it'll pass scrutiny in court and that it complies with the federal rules of evidence. And the federal rules of evidence, there's also something called the best evidence rule that if you have a photocopy of something, that photocopy could have been faked, which means that you don't have the wet sign signature on that suicide note. You have a photocopy of the suicide note, which means that the suicide note could be faked because as your, as any forensic pathologist will tell you, as a person writes with a ballpoint ink pen, they press deeper into that wood pulp adhesive, iron it out, and cut it thin stuff we call paper. And it's actually the loft on it, which is how much it stands up, is actually quite impressive under not even a high-power microscope. And what happens is that when the ball is pressing into it, it makes a little valley, and the valley is directly proportional to how much force you're exerting on it. Coincidentally, that's also what creates the friction coefficient satisfactory to cause the ball to roll and draw out more of the ink. And that ink, coincidentally, also does not ever completely dry. Most, at least most inks, do not completely dry. And so what happens is that a forensic pathologist, what will happen is that they'll show up in court and say, hey, look, this signature, although it looks like the prosecutor's or the defendant's, I've already analyzed it, and the depth at the intersection where the T is crossed is only half the normal depth, or this one is twice the normal depth, and the ink on this, I've traced it down, the recipe for it, all the makeup using it, and there's a technology called X-ray fluorescent technology, or XRF, and if you'd like to know more about that, it's very cool. But just do a search engine on XRF. And there's a there's some fabulous equipment out there for that you can actually get all the trace materials out of that ink just from a X-ray fluorescent technology device. And what will happen is he'll say, this ink wasn't made. The date here is signed December 12, 1963. This ink wasn't even manufactured till 1998, this recipe. And the iron content in this ink is much, much too high, or they'll say that the document here, this wood pulp paper, this particular recipe of it, was only available from one vendor during this period from 1981 to 2013, and this recipe was ceased. And so in 2017, when this is submitted for evidence, there should have been aging on here, but the date on it says 1976, so this recipe wasn't even available till 7 years later, and the aging of the wood and the pulp and the paper has not occurred, and is not older than 12 years old, and the ink, because it never dries, it would have slowly begin to saturate like moisture in a sponge into the adjacent fiber of the pulp. And what happens is that they'll say that the ink propagation in this pulp was not indicative of something that was signed in 1976. It's only indicative of the propagation for this particular recipe that would have been the equivalent of 10 to 12 years. And so what happens is that the best evidence rule requires a document that is an original, has an original signature, and if it's a printed document on an inkjet printer or a laser jet, what happens is that they can also do a forensic analysis of the typeface. When those type and typefaces were used, and not just that, but when the laser toner, and there's all different recipes of that, and some of them are very high, like for black and blue, you have a high iron content in those. And the different recipes are very, very hard to duplicate, and they're very date-specific. And then, the temperature on the toner drum. Oh, what is that? That's the drum that you transfer an optic image from the optical scanner, and they flash it using light onto this drum that it momentarily takes a magnetic image in the heat. And as it rolls through the toner, it picks up some of the toner and the temperature that drum is at. As drums get older, they get colder. There's usually a very large quartz light bulb. It's actually a long, thin diameter lamp, about between 5/8 and 7/8 diameter, and that's what heats it. But as time goes on, it's not near as hot. And so what happens is that they can trace the machine and guesstimate how much light, how far into that toner drum and the light source or the heat source that was on an original document. So these things, you know, some people say, well, John, you're getting a little overboard here, but when you're doing a forensic analysis of evidence, this is all stuff that's extremely fascinating for me. And what it means is that the reason why all of this is extremely fascinating is that knowing these little tidbits and the fact that we can document these and support these in court is fascinating to me, because that means the evidence that the individual we're trying to prosecute or defend, that we have something that will stand up in court. So knowing how and why all this works is an absolute, unbelievably wonderful, fascinating thing. So what evidence you can and cannot use in court, and what you can talk about and what you can't, if you start talking about stuff that you cannot support, could be accused of hearsay, or you haven't fully verified. That old joke about being turned into a laughing stock or being laughed out of court can begin to apply. And what happens is that even though you may know it's exactly true, I had a court case in 2000 where it never seemed, no matter what happened, no matter what motion we made for the judge, it was always, we were always ruled against. And then I come to find out that the senior partner for the attorney that was representing the plaintiff in this case was a 33rd degree Mason. The attorney himself was a 31st degree Mason, and the judge was only a 30th degree Mason, all in the same Masonic lodge, in the same city. And it was like, holy broken tree feathers, Batman. You know, do we have a serious conflict of interest here? Well, anybody who knows anything about Freemasonry knows that they have an oath to disembowel themselves or commit suicide, or allow themselves to be killed or taken, before they allow a senior member of their society to be taken. Was there a drop of evidence, or was there a drop of anything that we could do with that evidence? No, we didn't dare. That's something you just don't bring into court. We found a situation where the judge in this case was sleeping with one of the defendants, the defendant's wife, and had been sleeping with her for over 3 years when she came in on a traffic matter. She agreed to an abatement of her charges by him sleeping with her. When we found that out, it was in the middle of the trial, and the situation was such that he had actually since stopped sleeping with her, but we realized that at that situation, although this is absolutely heinous, there was nothing we could do in that situation, bringing that up. This gentleman, keeping him on the bench was the only way to save his booty. It was very, very serious. We had a good case going. The judge was kind of sympathetic. I say kind of. We realized he knew exactly who this guy was, you know, and when it was coming to trial, he broke it off with the wife. And when we found out about it, if we would have bought it up, it would have sank us instantaneously. Because the other judge that would have come in behind him, there was no ifs, ands, or buts, or candy, or nuts. He would have seriously convicted this guy. There's things that sometimes it's better part of discretion than valor. Better part of valor is discretion and good discretion. When you are looking at evidence that you want to bring into a situation, make sure that the people that if you're counting on a witness, that they will support and that they can withstand not just your examination, but the cross-examination. That's extremely, extremely critical. Right now, we're dealing with a cause in a particular state that our student, this particular state has been known for their wrongful behavior, especially when it comes to the Second Amendment. And right now, the Second Amendment, you know, where in the Constitution is who the right to keep bear a firearm in my pickup truck, let alone your courtroom, Your Honor. This judge, female judge, just blew it off without any questions. So how do we get that, and how do we go after that? Well, that's a good question. I'm glad you asked. That what we're starting to do is the legislation that enacted the statutes that they're referring to. We're going back right now and getting the House record for the state and the congressional session that enacted it, and we're finding out who signed on to it, and we're looking at the possibility of filing deprivation of civil rights under color of law suits against every state legislator that voted for that enactment. And so what happens is that in addition to that, we're going to have to go after not just the officer, not just the prosecutor, both prosecutors, but we may even have to go after the judge on this, and at the same time let them be very aware that the state legislators in federal court we're seeking prosecution against them, or suit, because they enacted a law that's a deprivation of civil rights under color of law. And that in this case, it looks like this may be the only way to win this case. It's very, very serious. The corruption level is so high that, you know, even when you're standing on your tippy toes, you feel you might be risking drowning in a courtroom. Right now, we're trying to figure out what evidence we can use against the judge. We're actually getting all the transcripts from all the hearings. In fact, we had a meeting today on just getting transcripts from all the hearings so that we can have the evidence to pursue the prosecutor. Now, for some of those of you who have some of you have more familiarity with some of the federal statutes than others, but there's when it comes to deprivation of civil rights under color of law, there's both criminal and civil statutes. Now, criminal statutes, the type of evidence gathering that you have to do in a criminal statute is very different than in a civil. And if you file a criminal case, you better have all your T's crossed and your I's dotted and be ready to go with all your evidence stacked up. Okay? Now, if you don't, you're going nowhere in it. Now, in a civil trial, they have something called discovery, where you can even propound interrogatories and admissions, and where the person is required to, you know, you can you ask just true or false. You have stopped stealing cookies from your mother. And that's not a good example, because that's a trick question. Because if they say, true, I've stopped stealing, oh, you were stealing, but now you're not, so you're still guilty. As they say, false, I haven't stopped, but you're still guilty. However you slice it, those questions are still guilty. But I throw that one out there just to show you that in civil, there's some, and I'll use the term fantastic, magic, abominable, I'll use them all in the same sentence there, ways to get your evidence and your testimony. Now, oh, wait a minute, John, you just used the term testimony and evidence. Yes, I did. Thank you for pointing that out. If you have a civil trial, you can garner loads of different kinds of evidence that, and you can get it directly from the person you're trying to pursue or prosecute, and you can get it in ways that you can't in a criminal trial. That, you know, wait a minute. That testimony and evidence is already entered in the record in the civil trial. So now when we go seek a grand jury indictment, we refer to the civil trial. This point, you know, this case in DCD number 213, on page 11, line 4, has their statement here, and the interrogatories and admissions interrogatories where we ask questions. Please, did you actually see the little old lady before you ran her down? You know, I mean, you ask these questions, but then when we go file a criminal negligent homicide, or maybe even a second degree felony homicide for running out this pedestrian, See, we've already got all that evidence, that testimony evidence, into the record in another case, and it's directly transferable. So sometimes, because it was already in one case, you could say that that testimony or evidence has been previously vetted, it was accepted into the record, and it may have even been tested or objected to and still survived the record. And so what's happening is that what you take into court and how you pursue this is extremely important, that you plan in advance the route that you're going to take from point A to point B. What you bring up in court, make certain that that you know will stand. There is an old saying, and I promise you, you ask anybody that's been to law school or anybody that's practiced law or been a judge or a prosecutor, et cetera, but you ask any of these individuals, and what happens is that you'll get this, the response on this is very, very simple. They say, you never ask a question in court that you don't already know the answer to or the answer that you will get. Okay? You never, ever, ever ask a question you don't know the answer you're going to get. Some people, you know, one student says, oh, I know that, professor. You never ask a question that you don't know the answer to. And the professor corrected him and says, you never ask a question that you don't know the answer they're going to give you. It's very, very important that you know which the evidence that you're going to seek, you're going to ask this individual, that especially if it's an adversarial witness, that you make certain you know exactly the answer you're going to get out of them. And if they're not going to give you the correct answer, what you do is you do a Ben Matlock, you know, the old the old dumb as a fox, Andy Griffith trick. You say, well, gee, your handwriting is this your handwriting on this document? It says this, you know, and you already signed the receipt. You know, it says you paid $10.12, but you said you only paid $3? Well, your receipt with your signature says it's $10 and right here. You know, which one is it? Be prepared to pull a Ben Matlock. By the way, if you never saw the show Matlock, there's some things about that actually go well in reality. And Andy Griffiths, dumb as a fox, you know, playing innocent and asking questions, not telling them, but asking thought-provoking questions, is very, very helpful. And one thing when you exude evidence from a witness, never, ever ask a question that you don't know the answer you're going to get from that witness, or that you don't have, and make sure that you have the horsepower with you that says you've got the receipt for $10.13 with you, so that, you know, if they decide to lie, that they can't, so that you can correct them, and especially if it's an adversarial witness, and show them to be what they actually are. Knowing what you can and can't say, and what you're going to ask and not ask, and the evidence that you can and cannot bring into a court situation is extremely important, and it's very important that you ponder all of that in advance. And so far we've seen many levels on tonight's call, about how that can go. And it ranges from just basic testimony. It ranges from evidence that you have, maybe you know it to be true, but it comes from somebody else, and they'll have to testify to that, that the fact that the shirt had a watermark stamped on it when it was at the laundry, there's a watermark on there, but when was it stamped? And the fact that, you know, the lady was able to, she wasn't able to testify for you at that time, that she was the one that stamped it on that day, or that you don't have one of the neighbors that actually saw the car drive across your lawn and knock your post box over, it's extremely important that you understand that what evidence you have there. Sometimes a photograph, they say, is testimony and evidence, you know, one picture's worth a thousand words. And if you can't determine what date that photograph was taken, it's unbelievably potentially problematic. I was giving a sworn deposition for a case against a civic entity here in the Houston area a couple of years ago, and it was a slip and fall accident, and the guy says, here, you know, you say you have these safety carpets all around this slippery surface, and you know that there's no place where people can pick up their toes, but look at this, you know, here's a picture, and there's none of those, in fact, there's a roll of those carpets sitting off the side, but there's none of those carpets out here, you know, and thankfully, right in front of everybody, I was able to say, you know, you got a good point there, but look at the conspicuous absence of people around and the fact that the work lights are still on and that the illumination from the daylight, the sunlight, is very nominal, which indicates that this was before the event started and before people started to get there. And the fact that the work lights were still on, that were turned off almost an hour and a half before the event started, were still on, and that those weren't distributed. They couldn't have been distributed yet because the crew that was distributing them hadn't arrived yet. So what happened was is that, you know, that's a good point. I'm glad you pointed that out. And here's the ABCs. You have to be able, you know, that picture was one of their opposing counsel's prize photos. They had actually a group of them that they had gotten from someone that they had subpoenaed from somebody's smartphone, that a lady that was participating, she was part of the defense. In fact, she was the chairman of the board for the local commission, you know, for the local business commission. And she, they subpoenaed her phone and those, and they were, they had already all but won the case when it was finally my testimony was there and I was looking at it, you know, and I pointed out that, oh, look at that. Look at the lighting, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, and we were able to set the time frame, and we were able to use the information that was available in it to date it and set the time frame. Certain times there's pictures like that where you don't dare use if you cannot document when it was taken. And a lot of photos right now, the metadata, if you have the electronic file, the metadata is there, and actually if it's been altered, the metadata will show that. But certain cases where you've taken a photograph and then you printed it or re-scanned it, there's no metadata with that photo. They're now starting to come to a place where they're starting to embed data dots into the digital photos so that if there's a high enough resolution scanner, they can read the metadata dot in there. But photos sometimes no longer pass for firsthand information, and they can be construed for different events. And so you have to be able to prove the time and day that, you know, that evidence was taken. The same thing with phone logs. If you have a phone log, and I'm currently dealing with a case where, with a student where, I had to get him to get all of his phone logs. And we not only had to prove that, they pointed out, well, he could have just dialed the, district attorney's office and nothing, you know, and then hung up, you know, or just put it on hold for, you know, but he had recorded every single call to the, prosecutor's office. And so that kind of put a teeny weeny bit of a damper on the corruption there. Getting evidence to support your evidence is very, very, very important. And to that end, when you're considering what you will present, whether it's a civil case or a criminal case, et cetera, think about how you're going to present that evidence and the veracity and integrity of that evidence. Earlier when I was talking about the federal rules of evidence, the Cornell Law's website is very, very good on it. And go up to Rule 800 and start reading on evidence there. There's a little book that you can get from Amazon if you're going to end up in court, that is one of the books that that I suggest that many of my students that we've had over the years, it's one that I encourage them unequivocally to get. There's a it's called Making and Meeting Objections, and it's very, very helpful. And it's available on Amazon very, very inexpensively. So when you get this one, it will explain to you the hearsay objection. But it's Making and Meeting Objections, and they're up to the second one now, but it's by Judge Robert Wanky. And there's also one by Ryan Steiger called Understanding Trial Objections. And both of those, they're together you'll probably pay about $55 or $65 for both books. One of them is a pocket size. Making and Meeting Objections is by Judge Robert Wanky is a very good one. The hearsay objections in hearsay, what it explains in there is extremely, extremely helpful. You'll understand a whole lot more after you read, section part 800 of the Federal Rules of Evidence. With that, we're going to turn it over to Q&A. You're not required to stay to topic subject matter. During question and answer, you can open it up to any topic that you so please. We've had situations where sometimes people ask two or three or four or half a dozen questions, and they monopolize to the point where we've had people that have indicated that they had to drop off because one person was monopolizing the questions. So what I'd like to do ask you to is that ask one question at a time, or if you indicate that there's two, let's make sure that they're just that they're related or one piggybacks off the other. And then after we're finished with your question, then raise your hand again. With that, back to you, Martin.
All right, folks, star two on your keypad if you have a question. Press star 2 on your keypad at this time to raise your hand. We'll call on you one at a time. Unmute you one at a time. If you're listening on the Freedom's Radio side, of course, go ahead and type your questions or comments in that question bar at this time. And don't forget to click submit. If you don't click the submit button, it's not going to pop up on our end. We won't see it. First question comes from Kent in West Virginia. Go ahead, Kent.
Good evening, John. Good evening, Martin.
Good evening, Kent.
Okay. I hope Mike's doing better.
How you doing tonight, Kent?
What's that?
How you doing tonight, Kent?
Oh, I'm doing okay. And yourself?
So I'm doing better than a mortal human being should be mortally allowed to be. And that's in spite of how much fun I may really be having.
What That's great. So, Right. Would you be kind enough to, I didn't understand whether you were talking about two different books or three different books. You said something about Making and Meeting Objections. I believe I'm familiar with that book. Then you said there was another one called Understanding, and I didn't get the rest of that title or the author. And then you said something about Hearsay and Objections, and I didn't understand whether or not that was a third book you were talking about.
Okay. Making and Meeting Objections 2, that's by Judge Rob Wanky. And you, the best place to get it, I find, is Amazon. And there's only two books. The other one is Understanding Trial Objection by Ryan Steiger. Okay? And if you review those, both of those books, one of them is a pocket guide that you can actually take into court with you. It's small enough that you can actually refer to it, and it's even Making and Meeting Objections, too, sounds like you're familiar with it. You probably remember it has the tabs on it so that you can actually be sitting there at the end, at the table, and you can quick tab over to, oh, wait a minute, how does that go? And you can look it up. But the other one is Understanding Trial Objections, three words, Understanding Trial Objections by Ryan Steiger. Okay?
Thank you. And the other day, you want me to hold this question because you just talked about people that have more than one question? The other day on another call, a question came up that we said should be referred to you. So I want to ask that question also, but if somebody else wants to go ahead of me, that's fine.
Well,
we're not that.
Go ahead.
We're not. Martin, Ken, go ahead.
Yeah, okay, thank you. So we were talking about a CRT actually owning property rather than it being in someone's quote-unquote name. And we're talking about property taxes and removing the land, this being two processes which would be accomplished, two separate processes, removing it from the property tax rolls and then removing the land from the U.S. presumed ownership. Now, I wanted to know whether or not this could happen because it was suggested that these are two processes that are being used to separate the property and free it of those obligations. I wondered how this could be used if there was a mortgage on the property, even if the CRT held it based upon Saint Germain or that case. So I didn't quite follow how this could come about. And when I got into asking the question, then it came down to, we want to refer this to John. Hello?
Did we lose? We did. We lost John. He fell off. Okay. 1 second. Don't go anywhere. Kent, everybody else, stay put. I'll be right back.
Okay.
Kent, you still there?
I'm here.
Yeah, my apologies. Technical error here. Okay, rephrase the question, please.
Okay, so the other night on another call, we were talking about CRTs. I believe it was on Bernie's call. And the CRT actually holding title to a piece of real property. And the procedures that were being used, and I believe you were included in this conversation, to remove the property from the property tax rolls, number one, but then there was something more complicated to be done, and that was to be removing the land from the U.S. presumed ownership. And I was questioning how this could actually happen if there was a mortgage on the property, because it was being said, or the way what I thought was being said, or certainly being suggested, was that, if you have the property in the CRT, you could do these two procedures. But my question was, if the property was in the CRT because of Saint Germain or for some other reason that it got there, but there was a mortgage or some kind of encumbrance on the property, how would one be able to necessarily remove it from property taxes, let alone do the second thing with the U.S. presumed ownership and removing the land from that? And at that point in time, it was said we should give this question to John.
Okay. There's a lot of different terms. Now, where did you get the term U.S. presumed owned land?
Off of the telephone call.
Okay, who used the term?
Well, I don't know whether it was Bernie or Mike that was talking about it. I'm pretty sure it was off Bernie's call. I have to look back at my notes. But they said that when the CRT owns the property, so I'm thinking CRTs is kind of Bernie's angle, so that's where I think it came from, that you're doing two procedures with the CRTs. And when I say you're, I gathered that somehow you were involved in this, that you were then first removing the property from the property tax rolls, and secondly, you were removing the land from U.S. presumed ownership. Because on the call, they said, well, just removing it from the property tax rolls isn't the whole picture. You have to understand that it has to be removed from the U.S. presumed ownership. Now, if I have somehow have this all fouled up, which I don't believe is the case, you know, I'll stand corrected. But, you know, finally it was said, well, you know, that's a good question. If there's a bank involved in this or something, how would you accomplish this? Let's ask John. So I got the idea that you were familiar with the two removal processes that were being spoken about. If that's not the case, well, then,
Okay, well, that's a good question. Would you like an answer?
I sure would. After all that, I definitely want an answer.
Oh, shucks, Ma.
But an actual answer to the question now.
Okay. See, now, removal from being paid, having to pay tax, getting that taken care of. The CRT is a, in itself, is a, an entity that is not required to pay the property tax. That under 26 USC 7611, and you can write that down, that's the restrictions on church tax inquiries and examinations. What it means is that the secretary may begin a church inquiry only if there's reason to believe that the requirements for that are stated later on in this, that it may not be exempt or for a reason that there may be unrelated trade or business being done that's not church related. Okay, but otherwise, apart from 26 USC 7611, if you claim that it's a church and it's in a charitable religious trust, and the blue border document, and that's charter for the trust, state that it's a charitable religious trust, unless they hold an investigation, they cannot strike that document down. And they have to have an investigation under 26 USC 7611 and that actually puts a fork in it and proves that you're coloring outside the lines. You're running a florist shop instead of a church here. We've only seen you selling flowers. You've never done a charitable event. You've not donated money to the homeless. You've not taken in the street people and fed them. You've not held a church service or a Bible study, whatever you claim you're doing. And see, a lot of the charitable religious trusts, there's individuals that, I know somebody up in one of the northern states right now that as a function of their CRT, they went and put up, donate, they went to a whole bunch of stores in their small town and put up donation buckets in the stores with the proprietor's permission that says, hey, we're soliciting donations for the homeless children of veterans killed in foreign wars, or the orphans. And they've got these little, and this is here by, and at the bottom it says, provided by, and it had the charitable religious trust, and it has the charitable religious trust on there. And what happened was that these guys they do this once a year, and they've, this charitable religious trust has only been in effect for 3 years, but they put those little donation jars in there. They're actually all pickle jars, you know, with a, with a lid with a slot cut in it, but they put the label on the inside of the glass, and they stick it on there on the inside so it can't be taken off, or, and they collect donations, and they make certain that they have an entity every single time. Every year it's been a different campaign, but that they make sure they get a receipt for every single penny that was donated. And what they do is they, their shop proprietor, you know, when they pick up the pickle jar, they say, would you mind, could we count this together, or could we count it up, and could I exchange it for larger bills to make it easy to carry? And that's usually the excuse they use. Can I exchange it? Would you be willing to accept all this change? And every time they say no problem, because some of them, but that's evidence that that charitable religious trust is actually a charitable religious trust. So, and what happens is that once you have that, then it qualifies under the exemptions for most of the county clerks, assessor collectors, tax code, so that you are no longer and you're no longer required to pay taxes on it. Now, if it's a charitable religious trust, if it's your personal residence, they're going to, some of them, or may, about 30% of them are going to ask what percentage is your personal residence, what percentage of the property belongs to the charitable religious trust. And, you know, you have to make that discretion there. You know, and if 5% of it's my residence, the other 95%, well, they're going to tax you on the 5%. But the
let me clarify what I'm trying to get to. If you have a mortgage in note, or one had a mortgage in note on the property, but under Saint Germain, put this in a charitable religious trust, there's another contract out there wherein property taxes are one of the things that would have to be paid as part of the terms and condition of that mortgage and that note. So if that's a contract, how can it be that you could then use the charitable religious trust to say, no, I don't have to pay the property taxes? Do you have a right to have the law, that the statutory law, so to speak, supersede what's in that contract, where let's just say a bank said, well, you've got to pay the property taxes, and if you don't pay them, we'll pay them for you, and add it back onto the mortgage? This is where I don't understand. Let me just simply draw an analogy. If you had a lease and somebody sold the property, but you had a lease and then they said, I want to move in and I want to get rid of you out of the property. Well, technically, the lease should move forward for the duration, the lease that you had with who's now become the seller of the property. And why should a state statute that says, well, you have to move out because they want to move in and the property was sold, then the state statute sort of takes over the private contract. And that's what I see happening here with what you're saying.
Okay. I'm going to exclude your example from the response, because I have a response for your first question. I just didn't get a chance to get it out. Okay. The charitable religious trust, is that a trust?
Yes.
Yes or no? Okay, good.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, on the charitable religious trust, every trust has a beneficiary, doesn't it?
I would presume so.
Okay. Now, are you the same person that is on the note that previously that would be the beneficiary as the charitable religious trust?
No, I suppose you could claim that you would be the American national in the trust, but you would be the corporate entity when you sign the note.
You overthink things way too much, Kent. Chill.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, you asked that.
Let's go back to being simple. The answer is yes. Your name is on there. What your status is has nothing to do with it. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
But your name is still on there. You're still the beneficiary. So under the Garn-St. Germain Act, written into office in February 1982 by then President Ronald Reagan, which is now in code 12 USC 1701 J-3, the presumption of the due on sale clause that means that you cannot sell it, or transfer it, without paying it off and having all that tax, everything apply, now is void. If a property is transferred into a charitable religious trust, the CRT, that you are the beneficiary for, then 12 USC 1701 J3 applies to you. And now the bank doesn't even get to, and I just got done with a Nevada student where the bank says they illegally transferred in the trust and everything else, and therefore now it's all due, and they tried to foreclose, and they actually foreclosed, and they got all the way up to the place where they got a eviction notice, and we got everything turned around. Everything's now turned around, and they are now the owners of the property. And in my hot little left hand, as we speak, I'm going to be traveling this Monday to file and record in Nevada the documents I have in my left hand that I'm setting back down at the moment, that they are now rightfully owner, and I have the fee simple title in my hand with the bank completely paid off, and it's a $1.3 million property. And that was how much was owed, $1.36 million. And I have a fee simple thing, and this couple paid nothing. Okay. But there's a handful of things that, right now, the presumption of due on sale, statute 12 USC 1701 J3 allows you to transfer that. Now, if the, and whether you're an American national or a U.S. citizen has nothing to do with this. This is exclusively under IRS code chapter 508. You've registered and you're qualified as a not-for-profit, and they stop taxing you. That's okay. And so what I'm gonna do is, Martin, do we have how long a line do we have, or can we continue with Kent for a little bit longer here? Martin's on hold.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, that mute button. Yeah, the mute button there. We do have one other that's been waiting patiently. I don't know if Kent doesn't object, we could just kind of pause for a second.
Okay.
Find out what this question is.
No objection. I yield as long as you come back.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to punctuate that question.
Yeah, I'm just going to leave you unmuted. Yeah. Yep.
Okay, I'm going to punctuate that question, Kent, in that because it is now in a CRT, and you can qualify under Chapter 508, 26 USC 508, your taxes. Now, this question when you posed it was exclusively in relationship to property in possession by a CRT. So the answer is yes. Now it's tax exempt. Okay.
Okay.
So now now let's go to the next question or the next question here or next request lines are open. Next contestant, please, Martin. Who are we talking to?
Go ahead, Jennifer, New York. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you. Marvin.
Lovely Jennifer, how are you?
Howdy, Johnny.
You go, girl. Okay, now I'm assuming you got all of everything that we just said with Kent.
Yes. Yeah, there's one question I have, though, that gave me a bit of a fright.
Okay.
You said I might have to pay taxes if I live at the church, if I live at the CRT property, I might have to pay taxes on that portion, but wouldn't I be the caretaker set up of the whole system looking after?
Bingo.
You know,
bingo. Bingo. Okay. Now I'm going to address CorpSol and CS and CRT on this. CorpSol and Charitable Religious Trust. Okay. The Charitable Religious Trust, what happens is that the individual that that is the caretaker, just like the CorpSol, anybody that is a CorpSol, that is the manager of the CorpSol, by a U.S. Supreme Court decision, it's a Florida decision, that what happens is that they're allowed to, shall we say, use the amenities of the assets of the corporation, and it's specifically states that the manager of the CorpSol can use all the amenities without any questions. And that's Reed versus Berry. That was the Florida statute, Reed versus Berry, 93 Florida 849. That's the statute that we're talking about there. Okay. So, and what happens is that the Charitable Religious Trust, when you talk with Justice Beshears, let him know, and there's sometimes you have to get an update on a Charitable Religious Trust or a CorpSol, and the term is called restating. Okay. And if you have to get your CorpSol or Charitable Religious Trust restated, so be it. And I say this because I know there's three people on the call that have CorpSols that one of them recently got theirs restated because they got it. It's a Utah CorpSol, and when they got it, they didn't know who Justice Beshears was. What I suggest to you is take a moment with Michael. Michael is right now somewhere, hopefully in Never Never Land, where you never land, sleeping. Michael is not feeling well right now. In fact, the situation today is he's very, very worn out. And I'm going to tell you that tomorrow at sunset begins Passover. And so, Justice Beshears, myself, Miguelito, and a whole bunch of us will be celebrating Pesach. I will be traveling to celebrate Passover with family and friends. And my problem is that one of the places where I'm going, I'm going to be out of pocket in semi-dark territory, meaning that the cell phone service is somewhere between slim and non-existent. Now, after that, I'm going to be traveling for a student. When I commented earlier that I had a package in my left hand, I was going to travel. I'm going to be taking Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, and we're going to do the closing on getting this property back to this couple, these students. It's a $1.306 million, property. And we just got everything rectified on it. And this couple happily is going to get their property back. And that, $1.306 million lien doesn't exist anymore. I just took care of that, got that taken care of last Friday, and all the documents I have in my hand are just, so I get back in pocket. I think my plane I depart Wednesday, but I think my plane gets in at just before 2 a.m. on Thursday. So if you want to make an appointment, we'll chat, touch base with Justice Breshears, and let's confirm that your CRT covers the caretaker, and we'll have him touch base with you and go over on that, and then we'll go ahead and get you off the tax rolls.
Great. Well, I'm nearly finishing my 4 years of, you know, bank statements that I didn't do because we didn't have to do a tax return, but I seem to have to do for the exemption. So I might. But are you coming back this Thursday, this week, or the following Thursday, a week later?
No. This Thursday is Passover. Passover begins, you know, the biblical reckoning of time. Today begins at sunset. You rest up first, and you work. You rest the first half, and you work the second half. That's the biblical reckoning of time. And so Passover begins at sunset on Wednesday night. And we will be celebrating Pesach and then into Shabbat, Sabbath, and then after that I'm traveling. And so it'll be next Thursday before I'm back in pocket. Give me a couple hours to sleep. Call me in the afternoon.
Sure. No problem. I should have all my documents ready for you to look at by then. Hopefully
Wonderful.
Before then. And I can show them to Bertie first, and then once he's made sure I didn't do anything wrong with the corp soul and CRT and everything, we can pass them on to you.
And it'll be an honor and a privilege to work with you on that.
Well, I appreciate that immensely, and thank you, and have a wonderful time with your family and Passover and with the other clients that must be elated.
Yeah, there's it's interesting. Yesterday and today, a third or half of the students have all indicated that they won't be doing anything on starting Wednesday night. And some of them I just asked, I said, so why is that? Well, there's something called Passover that we celebrate. And I said, wow, wahoo. For real? You know? And I found out that a lot of the students seek to serve the Most High King, and it's kind of a rush. And there's only two kinds of people. There's saints and saints to be, you know, and it's kind of cool, you know, when you get a chance to fellowship with a lot of the saints, you know. It's a downright rush, you know. With that, have we got you taken care of, Jennifer?
Yes, thank you. I appreciate your knowledge and sharing it. Thanks.
An honor and a privilege. Hey, take care of yourself, young lady. Okay.
You too.
Back to you, Martin. Do we have another person in line, or are we good to go back to Kent?
Yep, we're good to go back to Kent.
From Florida, it's Kent, or Virginia.
Okay.
Back to you, Kent.
John, so is it safe for me to conclude from what you just said when you clarified it before you went on to Jennifer, that the actual law that's in place, 12 U.S.C. Section 1701, J3, overrides the contract that one had with the bank? Is
okay.
that a good statement or not
okay.
correct?
Okay. With a qualification, or shall we say a clarification, the contract with the bank requires a due on sale clause, and every one of them requires a due on sale, meaning that if you sell it, there are certain things that happen. Or if you transfer it into a, you know, a corporation, et cetera, that all of this, changes. And that's one of the reasons why Justice Breshears Okay, hold on. Let me finish. Stop, please. Let me finish. Let me finish.
Okay.
That there's a handful of things that are required to be done under that contract with the bank. The one thing that's not, that doesn't happen now with 12 USC 1701 is that none of the due on sale clauses are required, which means that your loan is still your loan. Your note and your debt instrument is still your debt instrument. The property is no longer in your possession. You've gifted it into the CRT. The CRT because the property is there, it has been physically separated from you. Okay? It's now under the trust. And what that means is even though you're the beneficiary of the trust, it's still property of the trust. Therefore, whether there is a bank loan or not against it, you're the one that has the bank loan. Okay, it's collateral. The property is still collateral, and they can still foreclose on it, but it belongs to somebody else. It belongs to a trust now, but you're still liable for the note. The note has been technically separated from it. None of the consequences or precepts of the contract or the note apply if you are the beneficiary of the CRT.
Okay. And can you, as the beneficiary, then go in if there's a problem that requires this to go to court? Can you go in and, quote unquote, represent the CRT, or does that require an
attorney? Not as a beneficiary, you can't, because you don't own it, and you're just a beneficiary. The trustee must. And in certain states, they request that trust and corporation be represented by a licensed bar member. And we're in the process of fighting that in a couple of states right now, clarifying it for them. And the corp sole, or when we were talking about the Berry, Reed versus Berry, and also SLO versus Asher, both of those provide for the corp sole to, you know, the individual is the corp sole is the individual is the corp sole. So they don't, they're not required. It's a non-statutory religious trust or a corporation. So they're allowed to represent themselves, even when the state says you can't, because it's a non-statutory religious trust.
Okay.
And now go ahead.
Could you go on to the second part of my original question, where they were talking about the bigger part of this picture was removing the land from U.S. presumed ownership?
Okay. I want to know where you got that phrase, that statement, and where that comes from.
Well, I got it. The only thing I can tell you at this point, John, is I got it off the telephone call. That's what I heard them say. That the bigger picture was beyond the property taxes, was removing the land from U.S. presumed ownership or from the U.S. presumed owner. So I'm sorry, but I can't clarify it any further than that because I was left with the impression.
I'm guessing at what they're talking about, but I have never, ever, ever to this date heard that term used before. Okay. There's a whole lot of quagmire, and there's things that are wrong with that statement that are both illegal and unconstitutional. And so for somebody to say that it's removed from something that's illegal and unconstitutional, and that can't be stated, that's, you can't get there from here. So I want to know who said that. And, I need to find out what they were actually talking about and if this wording is what they were talking about. Which means that there is no such thing and it doesn't exist, or maybe that it got misconstrued and it should be worded some other way, and that this was your perception of it. But until I find that out, I don't have an answer for you. There isn't one. That concept doesn't exist, not to my knowledge. But not to my knowledge.
Okay, so what I should do is I'll look back at my notes and I'll go back to the appropriate call. And when I'm on that call, I'll raise this question and I'll see if I can't get it clarified.
Yeah, that sounds like that sounds like the best way to proceed on that. That's good.
Okay, and lastly, qualify one more thing if you could. You said that you were subtracting out of my question or out of the equation I gave you before my analogy, and maybe it was a poor analogy where I was trying to cite the thing about the lease, and is the lease as a contract between two people, does that hold more weight than statutory law, or does the statutory law hold more weight and override the lease? Because I saw that as an analogy, but you were saying, well, not quite so.
Let me ask you something. I'll ask you a question. I'll answer it by asking a couple of questions. Ready?
Okay.
Okay. Can you contract away your inalienable rights?
Yes.
Or let me rephrase that. Can you alienate your unalienable rights?
No.
There you go.
Okay.
Does that make it?
I guess that answers the question. Did you know what I was going to say before you asked the question? Oh, we're not in court. It doesn't matter. Okay.
Okay, my honored brother, did you have anything else there?
No, I think that's enough. Let's go on to somebody else.
Okay.
Let somebody else ask some questions.
Hey,
thank you.
Back to you, Martin.
All right, star 2 on your keypad, folks, if you have a question, or type it in on the Freedoms Radio side. So far, that's it.
Okay. Well, I've had a very long day. I've been up since 2:45 working. I've got a elderly widow that I'm working on a package for that is all pro bono, and I'm going to be up working on that again. So barring if that's all you have, Martin, then in closing, for all of you, it's truly an honor and privilege to serve the Most High King another day, another week with all of you. And I pray the Most High King's blessings be upon you, your lives, your wives, and your families. And may his peace go with you. And especially this week, there's a, however you choose to look at that unimpeachably present intelligent designer that's out there, there's however you choose to celebrate what he's done, do take time to celebrate that. Back to you, Martin. And I guess we're still doing chess call tomorrow night, correct?
No, there will be no call tomorrow night. The Wednesday night call, so we'll be back here on Thursday night, for our normal Thursday night call. And we will see you again next week.
The Most High King's blessings be upon you, my honored brother. Take care.
And you. All right, folks, and everybody have a wonderful and safe holiday. And until next time, be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.